want to see a few basic words about your brain, and I encourage you to try to imagine that right now as we speak here, what I'm describing is occurring in the coconut, right between the ears. And so, for example, this incredible organ that we have has really, really been shaped by evolution. It's been shaped biologically to accomplish all kinds of functions. The bad news is that some of those functions are fairly dark and selfish and difficult. The good news is that the dominant thread of those functions, the thrust of those functions, is toward cooperation and happiness and wholesomeness. So what is this amazing device, or if you could call it that? It's got over a trillion cells, 1.1 trillion cells in 3 pounds of what looks basically like tofu or cottage cheese. And of them, there are about 100 billion neurons. That's really kind of where the action is, the so-called gray matter. Each one of those has about 1,000 synapses or connections with other neurons. So you think about 100 trillion synapses. And on the average, each one of those is firing about 10 times a second. So in the time that I've been standing up here, literally quadrillions of synaptic events have occurred inside your head. It's just jaw-dropping to think about it. All that activity, of course, consumes a lot of resources. I mean, 2% roughly of the body weight, maybe 3%, consumes 20 to 25% of the body's oxygen and glucose and other resources. The brain is really busy. It's doing things. Let's hang on. One of the amazing things about the brain is its circularity. You have loops about loops about loops. And that's how we are fundamentally mindful. What is mindfulness? In terms of thinking about the brain, and I'll elaborate this more later, mindfulness is awareness. But it's a particular kind of awareness. But in general, what awareness is, if you think about it, is a representation of a representation. In other words, the brain is continually representing the world in various patterns of synaptic firing and structure. And awareness is the registration of those representations. Okay, so you can just kind of think about it as a second order process, a representation of a representation. But what that gives us is the capacity to reflect and to be aware of our experience and even be aware of awareness itself, even aware of awareness of awareness. You just go there in a way that's unprecedented in the animal kingdom. It's said that there are three great questions in science. What is the grand theory that connects all the forces in nature? Second, what caused the Big Bang? And third, what is the conscious self? In other words, what are you right now? It's right up there with the other two questions because it's so profound and so difficult and so important too. So, the brain is literally the most complex object known to science in the universe. More complex than a supernova, more complex than global climate change. The number of possible brain states, when you think of all the possible combinations of each synapse is basically an on-off switch. The number of possible brain states is one followed by about a million zeros. All right, that's more than the number of hydrogen atoms in the known universe. All right, you see the complexity of this amazing thing, which gives us all kinds of opportunities, right? And that's what I want to talk about right now. So your mind and your brain are basically one integrated system. I, like a number of people, think there's a mysterious X factor, some sort of transcendental factor that is in the mix. But if you set that factor aside with a sincere vow, what's left is the meat. It's 3 pounds of tofu is producing your understanding right now of what I'm saying, as well as all the other sensations running through your mind, all the other thoughts, all the other feelings, etc. It's all the brain. The brain is ground zero for conscious experience and unconscious experience. So you have this brain and mind, one system. As the mind changes, the brain changes. In other words, as you think different thoughts, different synapses fire, as you care about different things or activate different emotions, different parts of your brain get lit up, other parts get suppressed. The saying is that as neurons fire together, they wire together. In other words, experience, much as James was saying earlier, forges new circuits, for better or for worse. The more negative experiences we run through our brain, the more we form negative circuitry. The more we focus on wholesome experiences and joyous experiences, including, crucially, how we hold negative experiences, the more we strengthen that capacity to hold negative experiences and enjoy wholesome experiences. Little details just continue to astound me. For example, the brains of London taxi drivers are thicker in the parts of the brain that have to do with spatial memories, for example. Alternately, different forms of meditation. Some forms of meditation focus on concentration and absorption. Others focus more on a kind of spacious mindfulness of whatever is streaming through. Those activate different parts of the brain, those differences of type of meditation. So as your experience changes, your brain changes. But the other way is true too. As your brain changes, your experience changes. For example, over time, as James was alluding to in that study he quoted with Richard Davidson, people who meditate develop sort of more, they strengthen the circuits in the left frontal lobes. And what that does is activate more positive emotion. The more they meditate, the stronger those circuits. The stronger those circuits measured in MRIs, the more self-reported happiness. So going the other way, the brain changes the mind. The brain changes the experience. What that does, and now I'm getting to the money part of my little talk here, what that does is it gives us opportunities to use the mind to change the brain, to benefit the whole being and every other being we touch, including, I hope, the whole wide world. So let's take a look at one form of using the mind to change the brain, mindfulness, and particularly the epitome of mindfulness, which is deliberate mindfulness and meditation. So, good researchers have found that that meditation or the practice of mindfulness triggers different brainwave patterns that are associated with relaxed alertness. It activates positive emotion circuits, as I mentioned, in terms of the left frontal lobes, which promotes resilience. Positive emotion is fantastic. If you just Google positive emotion and take a look at research on it, the results are quite amazing in terms of the benefits, both in terms of physical health, like cardiovascular health, the immune system, and so forth, as well as for general well-being. Mindfulness practices increase serotonin. That's the neurotransmitter, as you know, that's responsible for regulating mood, but also sleep and digestion. Meditation and mindfulness thickens the anterior cingulate cortex. It's a part of the brain. You don't have to worry about these little details, but it's just cool to get the localization of it, you know, the realness of it. It's a part of a brain that is where we pay attention to attention. That helps us steady our attention, but it's also part of the brain that does something that I, as a therapist and a dad, really care about, which is being able to link thinking and feeling. In other words, it's easy to think when we're thinking and feel when we're feeling, but to bring thinking into feeling, which is hard when we're upset, or to bring feeling into thinking, which is hard if we're a more cerebral kind of person, that's a real challenge. And by strengthening this anterior cingulate cortex through meditation, you increase that ability as well. Another benefit of mindfulness practices is that it really strengthens a part of the brain called the insula. And the insula, also in the center of the brain, is responsible for what's called interoception. It's kind of a sixth sense where we pay attention to the internal state of our body. And that is the foundation of empathy. Because it's through paying attention to our own internal state that we get a gut feeling, we get a sense of what it's like to be another person. And my own opinion is that, you know, what the world needs now, probably more than any single faculty, my opinion, is empathy. Because it's through empathy that we really care about and we sense the suffering of others and we pay attention to our effects on them. Meditation and mindfulness also stimulate the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system. This is the rest and digest wing of the nervous system. That's the counter to the fight or flight sympathetic wing of the nervous system. And most of us live in a state of sympathetic overdrive. Fight or flight, It becomes a way of life. We're continually stimulated in that way. The counter to that is the parasympathetic nervous system, and mindfulness activates that. And then last, it activates and strengthens the immune system, and it improves cardiovascular health and dampens chronic pain. Pretty amazing benefits from one single intervention, mindfulness. So I want to talk about some of the ways you can promote your own mindfulness by understanding the brain states that support mindfulness. The first thing is to use basically the frontal lobes and to do what James had us do here in the first month, which is set an intention. You know, basically simply to form an intention and then keep that intention before the mind. I'm a big believer in practices. I mean, for me, there's a fundamental and appropriate humility in realizing that until we're irrevocably enlightened, we can always backslide, right? And so it really helps to have reminders around us, whether it's a little saying on the dashboard of our car or something inside our day timer or something we do when we first wake up in the morning, something that helps us regenerate that positive intention for mindfulness. The frontal lobes have tremendous back-feeding circuits into the emotion circuits. There are actually more nerve tracks going back from the frontal lobes into the emotion centers that come out of the emotion centers into the rest of the brain. The emotion centers are quick and powerful and primitive, but the frontal lobes have massive resources. They're just slower. They take longer. It's kind of like this slow army, you know. But when that army gets lumbering and catches up with the emotion centers, then they can really do something good. So the frontal lobes are very powerful. All right. Another thing is the parasympathetic nervous system. When we relax, it's a lot easier to be mindful. Have you ever noticed that? It's hard to be mindful when we're upset, but by just kind of taking a breath and recentering, that draws us back into mindfulness. Another key, I think, is great. If you read the traditional suttas, the enlightenment stories of the Buddha always involve him going into a forest and sitting with his back to a tree. All right? He's got his back covered. And as animals, basically the animal, as I said last time, that's really mellow and chill and tuning into the bliss of the light on the leaves and just kind of getting all, I call it the Esalen stare, you know, kind of really, wow, man, this is really great. Got eaten, yeah? So we evolved to be nervous, you know, irritable little critters. And so to bring our attention inward, particularly to be mindful of our interior state, rather than scanning the world for threats, really helps. And we have to kind of overcome our brain's tendency to be scanning out there for threats. And so by deliberately creating a sense of safety, relative safety, reminding ourselves of the ways in which we're secure today, that we're strong today, that we're surrounded by good company, that we're in a protected setting right now, for example, that we have resources inside our mind that we didn't have when we were vulnerable little children. That can also promote a sense of mindfulness. Another thing is the use of positive emotion. Here's a quick little lecture on how attention works. Basically, if you think about it, being stably mindful is unnatural. Let's start by acknowledging that. It's unnatural to do what James wants us to do. All right, sorry. It goes against nature in the sense that, as animals, we needed to continually scan, right? If we let our attention get locked onto one thing for too long, boy, we were at risk. So there's a constant tendency to look for the next thing, all right? How does it work? Basically, think about what we're attending to. Think of it as what's called working memory. I think of it as a little pasture, kind of a meadow. It's nice. It's got little things inside, and it's got a gate. Whatever's inside that little pasture, that's what we're paying attention to. That's what we're mindful of. All right? The gate gets popped open. In comes some new information that can capture our attention, and then it closes the gate while we pay attention to that new thing. All right? What pops open the gate? It's a pulse of dopamine. In other words, as dopamine's the neurotransmitter that's very involved with reward. So for example, if we get a sense there might be some reward over there, in other words, if the bananas in this tree are starting to get kind of boring, and those bananas look pretty good, go over there, right? That's how that works. Well, dopamine's also associated with positive emotion. So at the point that we're happy, really happy, let's say, there's so much dopamine in our system that a pulse of dopamine doesn't make a difference because it's already hit a ceiling. One of the words, two of the five factors of the jhanas are basically rapture and joy. Bliss and joy, bliss and happiness. And I think that's because high levels of positive emotion help us keep our attention stable. Isn't that cool? Is that great? If you are meditating, an interesting practice to experiment with is to give up conscious control of breathing. You're going to keep breathing, but basically you give up breathing. And which is an interesting experience of selflessness as well. But what that seems to do, I'm not exactly sure why, is give you a great experience of selflessness, and it also drops you into seeing how the body takes over. The body starts to breathe in a natural way, which draws you into the deeper layers of consciousness in the brainstem. The other thing is to increase stimulation. A lot of us have also gotten used to a pretty high stim rate, right? We don't have to have ADD to be hungry for stimulation sometimes. And sometimes it's really hard to just meditate on the breath. The breath is too boring. So it really works to extend stimulation by paying attention to the whole body of breathing. One of the key statements actually in the Buddha's comments about the mindfulness of breathing meditation is to experience the body of breath, or experience the body as a whole breathing. One of the things that I think is central to stable mindfulness is to be able to stay present with the whole wide field, right? And one way into that is to sense the body as a whole. I personally think that we evolved to really sense the body as a whole because we lived in a very nonverbal environment, and the right hemisphere is specialized to sense the body. When you're sensing the body as the whole, you're working with the right hemisphere, which is the more spatial, visual, nonverbal side of the brain. And yet now we live in an incredibly verbal world. Just think about what we're doing here tonight, me included. And so by being aware of the body as a whole, I think we're returning more to our own natural state, which is a doorway into this open field of sensing that's true mindfulness. Okay, a couple of quick things about mindfulness in daily life. I bet James is going to talk more about this, so I'll just hit a few high points. I find a few things from my own personal practice and talking and working with others really help bring mindfulness into daily life. One is to have a particular moment, ideally several times a day, where you just take 60 seconds or less to be mindful. For me, often it's a meal, where I just kind of reflect on the actual physical nature of the food I'm eating, in a literal sense. Where did this chicken come from? Or where did this corn come from? And play it all the way out, sometimes even thinking about the people who are driving the trucks, where they came from, the gasoline that produced those trucks, the sunlight, the DNA in domesticated corn, whatever. I feel all that going into my body, which really gives me a sense of being part of that whole thing in a very direct way. That's a moment of mindfulness. You might find your own. Thich Nhat Hanh talks about using the ringing of the phone as to be a temple bell to always call us back to mindfulness. Another is to slow down. Yeah, I don't know how many of you have ever read one of John Steinbeck's great novels, Sweet Thursday. He points out in there's this wonderful moment where this woman who is going on a date with this guy that she really thinks is great, and she's never been to a fancy restaurant before, and she realized that all she had to do was slow down. If she just moved more slowly, she could be present with what was happening, avoid any mistakes, and absorb a lot of information, plus feel cultured and dignified. And I think about that in a sweet way, that a lot of the people that you observe who are very mindful have a kind of peacefulness and slowness in the way they're operating in the world. We tend to drive, 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 and if we just slow down 1%, or even 10%, boy, there's so much more mindfulness. It can be quite hard to learn to steady the mind increasingly, but it is, on the other hand, truly foundational. As William James, the father of American psychology, said, an education of attention would be an education par excellence. The training of attention is an education par excellence. I consider attention to be basically our most fundamental tool for personal growth, because we have so much volitional control over what we put our attention on and how long we leave it there. And, you know, that's a great way to be supportive of ourselves. On the other hand, it's hard to do. So I want to close with this little story that I heard from Jack Kornfield. He says, "If you can sit quietly after difficult news, If in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbors travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you can happily eat whatever is put on your plate and fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or pill, if you could always find contentment just where you are probably a dog. All right.